אתם עם SBS בעברית. לעוד סיפורים מעניינים, כנסו ל-sbs.com.au.
Joining us now, we have Emeritus Professor Ilana Snyder, who has just received the Member of the Order of Australia in the General Division for significant service to the Jewish community of Australia and to tertiary education. Ilana, welcome to SBS Hebrew.
Thank you very much.
How do you feel receiving this award?
Oh, thrilled. And I feel it the terrific recognition, not just of my own work when I chaired the New Israel Fund, but of all the people I've worked with over the years at New Israel Fund and also in my professional life in higher education at Monash University.
And you were expecting these honours or was it a surprise?
No. You never expect these honours. It comes as a great surprise. Apparently the people who nominated me submitted the nomination at least 2 years ago. That's how long these things take. And I didn't know until I was contacted about probably 2 months ago to say that to ask me if I would accept the award, because there are many people who don't, because they don't believe, they don't believe in the honour system. I can tell you a little story. When a couple of years ago I wanted to nominate a woman who'd done an amazing job in the creative arts sphere. Part of the nomination is that you have to get 3 referees. I approached someone, a really senior person in Australia, really, who's just made an amazing contribution to the country in many, many ways. I asked him to be a referee because you try and get the best referees you can. And he said he doesn't believe in the honour system. He's never had one himself, and I'm sure he'd been offered them. He only agreed to do it because he loved the person who we'd nominated, and he did it just out of his loyalty and affection for her. But he said he absolutely does not believe in the system and would never accept one himself. So it's an interesting phenomenon.
Why would someone not believe in the system?
I'm not sure. He didn't actually give a reason, because it is Australian. As you know, it was established in the Whitlam era in 1975. Until 1975, they were British honours that we received in Australia as subjects of Britain. But in 1975, Whitlam changed all of that, established the Australian honour system. We're not kind of so colonial, really, because it is an Australian system now. But maybe it's the vestiges of being a colony of Britain. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a recognition that it's promoting people possibly at the expense of others who go unnoticed. I didn't actually question him. I was so dismissed when I thought he was not going to help me, that all I did was just try and, you know, persuade him to do it, and he did it. And this person did get an honour in the end. So
that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And do you actually find out who it is that nominates you?
No.
Okay. It's always a mystery.
Yeah. Well, it's not always a mystery. I mean,
you have your suspicions?
Some people don't. I do. I have my suspicions, but I don't officially know. No, you're not supposed to. It's supposed to be. I certainly didn't know a process had been initiated. Absolutely not 2 years ago. But when I was notified by the association, I kind of had my suspicions, because I think the point is that it was really for my, I think more so for my voluntary work with the New Israel Fund in the Jewish community than for my professional work in higher education. You know, in higher education, you know, I made a contribution as a researcher, but it was part of my professional life, everything that I did there. I was paid for it. It was, you know, what was expected of me in my role at Monash and in the education sphere. But the New Israel Fund was completely voluntary and subsumed my life after I retired in 2015.
Yeah, and that recognition is also part of your award for significant service to the Jewish community.
Absolutely. So, I think it's really more than the other. That's the point I'm making. It's more about my contribution to the Jewish community through my work with the New Israel Fund than for my career in higher education.
So let's get into that. You've been the president of the New Israel Fund for a number of years, from 2015 to 2022. And before that, you were a board member since 2014. So what was it about the New Israel Fund that attracted you to join the organisation?
I was just really lucky, because I found an organisation that aligned with my values and my political beliefs and my total commitment to Israel. as a country and as a state in the belief that Israel can be better than it's been. And this has really been highlighted since October 7, after the horrors of October 7 and the terrible Gaza war. I mean, many of the actions of the government and under Netanyahu are just reprehensible. And I belong to an organization it's not a political organization, so it doesn't work to topple Netanyahu, but it works with organizations on the ground that are working for peace and resolution and, keeping people together rather than polarizing them and splitting them apart.
So it's more humanitarian.
It's humanitarian, yes. It's basically an American organization that now has global affiliates. For example, like the one that's an absolute standout organization since October 7 is an organization called Standing Together, which has become more important than it ever was, which is an organization that comprises Israeli Jews and Israeli Palestinian. So that's the 20% of Arabs within Israel, working together for peace and to enhance understanding and to help people to live together and to recognize that each other are human beings and we can work together and live together in peace. Well, that organization has kind of really come to preeminence since October 7. They've done an amazing tour of America. We had two people. We didn't get the leaders of the organization. But we got two people, deputy leaders, I suppose you'd call them, who came to Australia and did some work for us here. It's, they always send one Jewish Israeli and one Palestinian Israeli, and when you hear them speak and their dialogue and their respect for each other and their complete acknowledgement of the humanity of each other, which is something, it sounds so basic. But, it's not assured. For example, since October 7, which was obviously horrific and terrible situation and the hostages taken and still some not returned and so many have died in captivity. Since October 7, for example, members of Standing Together, activists on the ground in Israel have been fearful of going into the streets in Israel because they're immediately identifiable. Not quite sure how, but, maybe when they open their mouths and they speak Hebrew with an accent, identifiable as Israeli Arabs, and they've been fearful of their lives, of being attacked. Well, not so much fearful of their lives, but at being harassed, attacked, rejected. So I've heard stories of people who didn't leave their houses. They just stayed in their villages and did their basic living and didn't go outside their villages for about 6 months after October 7. They were fearful. Just terrible. What a terrible situation.
These are some of the stories that we sort of lose sight of in amongst all the reprehensible stories that come out of this war. So it's very important to highlight everyone's stories. So given the current context of this war with Gaza, have any of the initiatives, for example, been inoculated because of the war, or have they been compromised because of the war?
Okay, that's a really good question. Immediately after October 7, NIF got into action, and we were part of a food lift to people in Gaza straight after the war broke out. So we worked with organisations, in fact, our own organisations, but also other NGOs on the ground. We helped house the displaced Israelis from the north and from the kibbutzim from the south. So we're helping them find hotels and food and childcare and all of the things that these people needed immediately, because it took the government weeks to get into action. So the NGOs that we support to allow them to, to do things. So that was the thing that we did immediately. An organization that New Israel Fund support is called Gishah, which has always worked with people in Gaza. So the same kind of work that Rosanna does, getting people from Gaza to hospital, the treatment, helping people get through crossings, border crossings, and such, the family reunions for whatever reason. Gishah has always been a very important organization. But its activities were curtailed. You asked me that. What happened to some of those organizations? As soon as the war broke out, Gishah was very limited. It couldn't resume what it's always done. It couldn't be taking people, you know, people were dying rather than getting to their cancer treatment. I should have looked this up before I spoke to you. I'm not actually sure what Gishar has been doing, but it's a beautiful example of an organization that has had to find other things to do in this since the crisis, since the war began, because it can't operate as it used to.
Let me ask you a bit of a curly question. If someone does believe in the Israeli government as it stands, the status quo, could they still be part of the New Israel Fund, or is that too oxymoronic?
Well, no, it's not too oxymoronic. I mean, it's not a membership organisation. It's an organisation that engages people in activities, and the main way that you get engaged, people find their way into the New Israel Fund community because of their views, their personal values, their views about Israel and Israel's potential. I think probably the basic quality is that there's a love of Israel. NIF supporters still mainly call themselves Zionist, although that word is so bloody loaded these days, but it's a word that polarizes rather than engages people. The organization is founded on a love of Israel and a belief that Israel can be better, that democracy is under threat in Israel, and increasingly so since October 7 and the rule of Netanyahu. At the moment, there's no accountability.
And what about the role of Hamas? What role do they play in all of this?
Well, the role of Hamas is a terrorist organisation, and of course we recognise Hamas as a terrorist organisation.
In brief, would you say that with replacing Netanyahu with a left-wing government, relations might ameliorate between both sides?
That's a very good question, but there will never be a left-wing government while I'm alive. You know, I'm in my 70s and I think that that's highly unlikely. No, I have a left.
Or an alternative.
No, just to the left to rebuild, because there needs to be a left-wing bloc. I'm not asking for power or for, because that's just completely unrealistic, but at least to resurrect itself, to apply, to be there for checks and balances on a government that's increasingly, we just can't hold the government to account. But let me just give you a little, very, very brief history. I don't know if I did this last time I spoke to you, Mariel, just about the beginnings of the New Israel Fund. It began after peace with Egypt, and a couple who'd originated in South Africa in San Francisco. Suddenly, in 1979, and they're still alive there, so very important people working for the New Israel Fund, said, look, this is the beginning. This is the beginning of a wonderful future, peace with Egypt. And Jordan, of course, came later. This is just the beginning, and we can get peace with all of the Arab countries, and Israel is going to have a shiny future. And they formed the New Israel Fund to support organizations that were building democracy, building equality, building all of those things, fighting for democracy. And now we know, in the last few years in particular, democracy is increasingly under threat in Israel, and to describe Israel as a democracy. When we saw Netanyahu fly off to Hungary today to meet his good friend in Hungary, and this is the illiberal countries in the world that Israel is meeting with, and it's pretty scary. I know, and it's Hamas. Well, I mean, I think it's also naive to think that Hamas can be destroyed. I think that the weakening of the Palestinian Authority was deeply problematic. It completely discredited organization. But it's not a terrorist organization. So the Palestinian Authority, or people who are aligned with those kinds of beliefs, it would have been better if Netanyahu had tried to strengthen them rather than inadvertently strengthening Hamas. Hamas is a terrible organization. What happened on October 7th, it was just awful, as we all know. The hostages, the stories of the hostages are just awful. And I live in Australia. And I'm, you know, very aware of the different reality that people in Israel experience. As we all are in contact with our family and friends in Israel, it's completely different for them. You know, when I talk about the things I've said to you, my left-wing family in Israel just would say what you've just said, that it's naive. It's hard stuff. It's very difficult, but I can only hope for something better. That's the way I do life, hoping for something better. It's not eventual, but yeah. But hoping that Israel can do better, and I'm sure Israel can do better, but unfortunately it probably won't be in my lifetime, which I can't believe that so much has happened to change things over the past, 16 months or 15 months, however long it is since October 7th.
Can we bring the focus back here in Australia? You have published some books on literacy and education. Tell us a little bit about what motivated you to do that, and which of your contributions do you feel has had the greatest impact?
I was a school teacher, an extremely happy school teacher. I loved my year as an English teacher in secondary school. And then I had an opportunity to do a PhD, and that was in the mid-80s. Computers were just coming into education, or coming into the world, really, but into education. And so I just thought there was enormous potential for writing in particular, seeing a computer as a writing tool. So I did research on computers in classrooms, in secondary classrooms. And that began my whole kind of search program and teaching program for my career as an academic, because as soon as I got my PhD, that was a license to get a job in a university. So I moved from the secondary sector to Monash University. My focus has always been on new media, digital media, the use of technology in classrooms, and above all, on critical literacy, on being able to critically use these new tools. And so it was something like literacy, the tradition of progressive views of literacy have always been had an emphasis on the critical, helping kids engage with their world and media with a critical lens. And so this was just a new environment, and applying those really important ideas to the new environment, the new digital media environment. So that's what I did my research on. I did my first book was a book called Hypertext, which was published in the mid-90s. And that was about basically what we do with the internet. So it was thinking, it's kind of a theoretical book talking about how these new technologies relate to theoretical ideas about the way we see the world, but also the way we do reading and writing and literacy. So that was the first one. And then I did, published lots of stuff about this area and did lots of teaching in my field at Monash. But the next major book was called The Literacy Wars, which was in the, I think that was published in about 2008 or 2009.
So Ilana, what's the conclusion? Do computers harm or advance literacy?
Well, we don't polarize in terms of our political views. It's not an either or question. I mean, technology, new media and technology, the environment in which we do our life now. And let's just hope that we can help our young people use these technologies wisely with critique, with understanding, and, not to be to look at everything with a critical eye, absolutely with a critical eye.
Very important. And we'll leave it there with you. Thank you so much, Professor Ilana Snyder.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
רוצים לשמוע עוד סיפורים? האזינו דרך האפל פודקאסט, גוגל פודקאסט, ספוטיפיי, או בכל מקום אחר בו ניתן להאזין לפודקאסטים.